to maintain and defend its privileges against what was profitably regarded as an inferior caste. We accept the illogic of race because these are the things we have been told. We see a person with skin that is whiter than that of most white people, and we accept that they are not white and thus of a different category because of the minutest difference in the folds of their eyelids and because, perhaps, their great-grandparents were born in Japan. We see a person whose skin is espresso, darker than most black people in America, and accept that he is, in fact, not black, absolutely not black, and is thus a completely separate category, because his hair has a looser curl, and perhaps he was born in Madagascar. We have to be taught this illogic. Small children who have yet to learn the rules will describe people as they see them, not by the political designations of black, white, Asian, or Latino, until adults correct them to use the proper caste designations to make the irrational sound reasoned. Color is a fact. Race is a social construct. We think we see race when we encounter certain physical differences among people, such as skin color, eye shape, and hair texture, the Smedleys wrote. What we actually see are the learned social meanings, the stereotypes that have been linked to those physical features by the ideology of race and the historical legacy it has left us. And yet, observed the historian Nell Irvin Painter, Americans cling to race as the unschooled cling to superstition. The word caste, which has become synonymous with India, did not, it turns out, originate in India. It comes from the Portuguese word casta, a Renaissance-era word for race or breed. The Portuguese, who were among the earliest European traders in South Asia, applied the term to the people of India upon observing Hindu divisions. Thus, a word we now ascribe to India actually arose from Europeans' interpretations of what they saw. It sprang from the Western culture that created America. The Indian concept of rankings, however, goes back millennia and is thousands of years older than the European concept of race. The rankings were originally known as varnas, the ancient term for the major categories in what Indians have in recent centuries called the caste system. The human impulse to create hierarchies runs across societies and cultures, predates the idea of race, and thus is farther reaching, deeper, and older than raw racism and the comparatively new division of humans by skin color. Before Europeans expanded to the New World and collided with people who looked different from themselves, the concept of racism as we know it did not exist in Western culture. Racism is a modern conception, wrote the historian Dante Puzzo, for prior to the 16th century, there was virtually nothing in the life and thought of the West that can be described as racist. The R word. What we face in our current day is not the classical racism of our forefathers' era, but a mutation of the software that adjusts to the updated needs of the operating system. In the half century since civil rights protests forced the United States into making state-sanctioned discrimination illegal, what Americans consider to be racism has shifted. And now the word is one of the most contentious and misunderstood in American culture. For the dominant caste, the word is radioactive, resented, feared, denied, lobbed back toward anyone who dares to suggest it. Resistance to the word often derails any discussion of the underlying behavior it is meant to describe, thus eroding it of meaning. Social scientists often define racism as the combination of racial bias and systemic power, seeing racism, like sexism, as primarily the action of people or systems with personal or group power over another person or group with less power. As men have power over women, whites over people of color, and the dominant over the subordinate. But over time, racism has often been reduced to a feeling, a character flaw, conflated with prejudice, connected to whether one is a good person or not. It has come to mean overt and declared hatred of a person or group because of the race ascribed to them, a perspective few would ever own up to. While people will admit to or call out sexism or xenophobia and homophobia, people may immediately deflect accusations of racism, saying they don't have a racist bone in their body or are the least racist person you could ever meet, that they don't see color, that their best friend is black, and they may have even convinced themselves on a conscious level of these things. What does racist mean in an era when even extremists won't admit to it? What is the litmus test for racism? Who is racist in a society where someone can refuse to rent to people of color, arrest brown immigrants en masse, or display a Confederate flag, but not be certified as a racist unless he or she confesses to it or is caught using derogatory signage or slurs? The fixation with smoking out individual racists or sexists can seem a losing battle in which we fool ourselves into thinking we are rooting out injustice by forcing an admission that A, is not likely to come, B, keeps the focus on a single individual rather than the system that created that individual, and C, gives cover for those who, by aiming at others, can present themselves as noble and bias-free for having pointed the finger first, all of which keeps the hierarchy intact. Oddly enough, the instinctive desire to reject the very idea of current discrimination on the basis of a chemical compound in the skin is an unconscious admission of the absurdity of race as a concept. This is not to say that the consequences of this social construct are not real, or that abuses should not be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. It is to say that the word racism may not stand as the only term or the most useful term to describe the phenomena and tensions we experience in our era. Rather than deploying racism as an either-or accusation against an individual, it may be more constructive to focus on derogatory actions that harm a less powerful group, rather than on what is commonly seen as an easily deniable, impossible-to-measure attribute. With no universally agreed-upon definition, we might see racism as a continuum rather than an absolute. We might release ourselves of the purity test of whether someone is or is not racist and exchange that mindset for one that sees people as existing on a scale based on the toxins they have absorbed from the polluted and inescapable air of social instruction we receive from childhood. Caste, on the other hand, predates the notion of race and has survived the era of formal state-sponsored racism that had long been openly practiced in the mainstream. The modern-day version of easily deniable racism may be able to cloak the invisible structure that created and maintains hierarchy and inequality. But caste does not allow us to ignore structure. Caste is structure. Caste is ranking. Caste is the boundaries that reinforce the fixed assignments based upon what people look like. Caste is a living, breathing entity. It is like a corporation that seeks to sustain itself at all costs. To achieve a truly egalitarian world requires looking deeper than what we think we see. We cannot win against a hologram. Caste is the granting or withholding of respect, status, honor, attention, privileges, resources, benefit of the doubt, and human kindness to someone on the basis of their perceived rank or standing in the hierarchy. Caste pushes back against an African-American woman who, without humor or apology, takes a seat at the head of the table speaking Russian. It prefers an Asian-American man to put his technological expertise at the service of the company, but not aspire to CEO. Yet it sees as logical a 16-year-old white teenager serving as store manager over employees from the subordinate caste three times his age. Caste is insidious and therefore powerful because it is not hatred. It is not necessarily personal. It is the worn grooves of comforting routines and unthinking expectations, patterns of a social order that have been in place for so long that it looks like the natural order of things. What is the difference between racism and casteism? Because caste and race are interwoven in America, it can be hard to separate the two. Any action or institution that mocks, harms, assumes or attaches inferiority or stereotype on the basis of the social construct of race can be considered racism. Any action or structure that seeks to limit, hold back, or put someone in a defined ranking, seeks to keep someone in their place by elevating or denigrating that person on the basis of their perceived category, can be seen as casteism. Casteism is the investment in keeping the hierarchy as it is in order to maintain your own ranking, advantage, privilege, or to elevate yourself above others or keep others beneath you. For those in the marginalized castes, casteism can mean seeking to keep those on your disfavored rung from gaining on you, to curry the favor and remain in the good graces of the dominant caste, all of which serve to keep the structure intact. In the United States, racism and casteism frequently occur at the same time, or overlap or figure into the same scenario. Casteism is about positioning and restricting those positions vis-a-vis others. What race and its precursor racism do extraordinarily well is to confuse and distract from the underlying structural and more powerful Sith Lord of caste. Like the cast on a broken arm, like the cast in a play, a caste system holds everyone in a fixed place. For this reason, many people, including those we might see as good and kind people, could be casteist, meaning invested in keeping the hierarchy as it is or content to do nothing to change it, but not racist in the classical sense, not active and openly hateful of this or that group. Actual racists, actual haters would by definition be casteist, as their hatred demands that those they perceive as beneath them know and keep their place in the hierarchy. In everyday terms, it is not racism that prompts a white shopper in a clothing store to go up to a random black or brown person who is also shopping and to ask for a sweater in a different size, or for a white guest at a party to ask a black or brown person who is also a guest to fetch them a drink, as happened to Barack Obama as a state senator, or even perhaps a judge to sentence a subordinate caste person for an offense for which a dominant caste person might not even be charged. It is caste, or rather the policing of and adherence to the caste system. It's the autonomic, unconscious, reflexive response to expectations from 1,000 imaging inputs and neurological societal downloads that affix people to certain roles based upon what they look like and what they historically have been assigned to, or the characteristics and stereotypes by which they have been categorized. No ethnic or racial category is immune to the messaging we all receive about the hierarchy, and thus no one escapes its consequences. What some people call racism could be seen as merely one manifestation of the degree to which we have internalized the larger American caste system, a measure of how much we ascribe to it and how deeply we uphold it, act upon it, and enforce it, often unconsciously in our daily lives. When we assume that the woman is not equipped to lead the meeting, or the company, or the country, or that a person of color or an immigrant could not be the one in authority, is not a resident of a certain community, could not have attended a particular school, or deserved to have attended a particular school, when we feel a pang of shock and resentment, a personal wounding and sense of unfairness, and perhaps even shame at our discomfort upon seeing someone from a marginalized group in a job or car or house or college or appointment more prestigious than we have been led to expect, when we assume that the senior citizen should be playing Parcheesi rather than developing software, we are reflecting the efficient encoding of caste, the subconscious recognition that the person has stepped out of his or her assumed place in our society. We are responding to our embedded instructions of who should be where and who should be doing what, the breaching of the structure and boundaries that are the hallmarks of caste. Race and caste are not the cause and do not account for every poor outcome or unpleasant encounter. But caste becomes a factor to whatever infinitesimal degree in interactions and decisions across gender, ethnicity, race, immigrant status, sexual orientation, age, or religion that have consequences in our everyday lives and in policies that affect our country and beyond. It may not be as all-consuming as its targets may perceive it to be, but neither is it the ancient relic, the long-ago anachronism that post-racialists, post-haters of everything, keep wishing away. Its invisibility is what gives it power and longevity. Caste, along with its faithful servant race, is an X factor in most any American equation, and any answer one might ever come up with to address our current challenges is flawed without it. Chapter 7. Through the Fog of Delhi to the Parallels in India and America. The flight to India landed in a gray veil that hid the terminal and its tower at the International Airport in Delhi. It was January 2018, my first moments on the subcontinent. The pilot searched for a jetway through the drapery of mist. It was 2 a.m, and it was as if we had landed in a steam kettle. We're still airborne in a cloud, the night air pressing against cabin windows, and we could see nothing of the ground. I had not heard of rain in the forecast and was fascinated by this supernatural fog in the middle of the night until I realized that it was not fog at all, but smoke from coal plants, cars, and burning stubble trapped in stagnant wind. The pollution was a shroud at first to seeing India as it truly was. At daybreak, the sun pushed through the haze, and once I connected with my hosts, I raced along with them to cross an intersection, an open stretch of asphalt, with cars hurtling in every direction, with no lanes or speed limits. We made our way along the side streets to the conference we were attending. I saw the wayside altars and mushroom temples with their garlands and silk flowers to the Hindu deities at the base of the sacred fig trees. There, commuters can pause for reflection as they head to work or an exam or a doctor's visit. The sidewalk shrines seemed exotic to me until I thought of the American ritual of spontaneous altars of flowers and balloons at the sight of something very different, at the sight of an accident or tragedy. As for the young woman killed at the infamous rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, just months before. Both reflect a human desire to connect with and honor something or someone beyond ourselves. The United States and India are profoundly different from each other in culture, technology, economics, ethnic makeup. And yet, many generations ago, these two great lands paralleled each other, both protected by oceans and ruled for a time by the British, fertile and coveted. Both adopted social hierarchies and abide great chasms between the highest and the lowest in their respective lands. Both were conquered by people said to be Aryans arriving, in one case, from across the Atlantic Ocean, in the other, from the north. Those deemed lowest in each country would serve those deemed high. The younger country, the United States, would become the most powerful democracy on earth. The older country, India, the largest. Their respective hierarchies are profoundly different, and yet, as if operating from the same instruction manual translated to fit their distinctive cultures, both countries adopted similar methods of maintaining rigid lines of demarcation and protocols. Both countries kept their dominant caste separate, apart, and above those deemed lower. Both exiled their indigenous peoples, the Adivasi in India, the Native Americans in the United States, to remote lands and to the unseen margins of society. Both countries enacted a fretwork of laws to chain the lowliest group, Dalits in India and African Americans in the United States, to the bottom, using terror and force to keep them there. Perhaps only the Jews have as long a history of suffering from discrimination as the Dalits, wrote the Dalit journalist V.T. Rajshekhar. However, when we consider the nature of the suffering endured by the Dalits, it is only the African-American parallel of enslavement, apartheid, and forced assimilation that comes to mind. Both countries have since abolished the formal laws that defined their caste systems. The United States in a series of civil rights laws in the 1960s, and India decades before in the 1940s. But both caste systems live on in hearts and habits, institutions, and infrastructures. Both countries still live with the residue of codes that prevailed for far longer than they have not. This description of caste history from the 2017 Indian book Ground Down by Growth could be said of the American caste system with only a few word changes. The colonial powers officially abolished slavery in India. We could replace the word India with the United States. In 1843, or in the case of the United States, 1865. But this simply led to its transformation into bondage through relations of debt, what has been called debt peonage by scholars. In both countries and at the same time, the lowest castes toiled for their masters. African Americans in the tobacco fields along the Chesapeake or in the cotton fields of Mississippi, Dalits plucking tea in Kerala and cotton in Nandurbar. Both worked as enslaved people and later for the right to live on the land that they were farming. African Americans in the system of sharecropping, Dalits in the Indian equivalent known as saldari. Both still confined to their fixed roles at the bottom of their respective worlds. Both occupy the lowest positions on the status hierarchies in their societies, wrote Harvard political scientist Sidney Verba and his colleagues in a study of Dalits and African Americans. Both have been particularly singled out from other groups based on characteristics ascribed to them. While doors have opened to the subordinated castes in India and in America in the decades since discrimination was officially prohibited, the same spasms of resistance have afflicted both countries. What is called affirmative action in the United States is called reservations in India, and they are equally unpopular with the upper castes in both countries, language tracking in lockstep, with complaints of reverse discrimination in one and reverse casteism in the other. There are many overarching similarities, but but they are not the same in how they are structured or operate. The American system was founded as a primarily two-tiered hierarchy, with its contours defined by the uppermost group, those identified as white, and by the subordinated group, those identified as black, with immigrants from outside of Europe forming blurred middle castes that sought to adjust themselves within a bipolar structure. The Indian caste system, by contrast, is an elaborate fretwork of thousands of subcastes, or jatis, correlated to region and village, which fall under the four main varnas: Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra, and the excluded fifth, known as untouchables or Dalits. It is further complicated by non-Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, and Christians, who are outside the caste system but have incorporated themselves into the workings of the country and, while eschewing rigid caste, may or may not have informal rankings among themselves and in relation to the varnas. Unlike the United States, which primarily uses physical features to tell the castes apart, in India, it is people's surnames that may most readily convey their caste. Dalit names are generally contemptible in meaning, referring to the humble or dirty work they were relegated to, while the Brahmins carry the names of the gods. Generally, you must know the significance of the name, learn the occupation of their forefathers, and perhaps know their village or their place in the village to ascertain their caste. But after centuries of forced submission and in-group marriage, they may also be identified by their bearing, accents, and clothing, all of which, over the centuries, were required to be lowly and menial, as well as a tendency to be darker than upper caste people, though not always. The Indian caste system is said to be stable and unquestioned by those within it, bound as it is by religion and in the Hindu belief in reincarnation, the belief that one lives out in this life the karma of the previous ones, suffers the punishment or reaps the rewards for one's deeds in a past life, and that the more keenly one follows the rules for the caste they are born to, the higher their station will be in the next life. Some observers say that this is what distinguishes the Indian caste system from any other, that people in the lowest caste accept their lot, that it is fixed and unbending, that Dalits live out their karma decreed by the gods and do their lowly work without complaint, knowing not to dream of anything more. In order to survive, some people in a subordinated caste may learn and believe that resistance is futile. But this condescending view disregards generations of resistance, as well as the work of Ambedkar and the reformer Jyotipa Phule before him. It was also wrongly assumed of enslaved Africans, and it disregards a fundamental truth of the species, that all human beings want to be free. The Dalits were no more contented with their lot than anyone would be. In a caste system, conflating compliance with approval can be dehumanizing in itself. Many Dalits looked out beyond their homeland, surveyed the oppressed people all over the world, and identified the people closest to their lamentations. They recognized a shared fate with African Americans, few of whom would have known of the suffering of Dalits. Some Dalits felt so strong a kinship with one wing of the American civil rights movement and had followed it so closely that in the 1970s, they created the Dalit Panthers, inspired by the Black Panther Party. A few years ago, a group of African American professors made a trip to a rural village in Uttar Pradesh, India. There, hundreds of villagers from the lowliest subcaste, the scavengers, came together for a ceremony to welcome the Americans. The villagers sang Dalit liberation songs for the occasion. Then they turned to their American guests and invited them to sing a liberation song of their own. a law professor from Indiana University, Kenneth Dow Schmidt, began a song that the civil rights marchers sang in Birmingham and Selma before they faced sheriff's dogs and water hoses. As he reached the refrain, the Dalit hosts joined in and began to sing with their American counterparts. Across the oceans, they well knew the words to "We Shall Overcome." Chapter 8. The Nazis and the Acceleration of Caste. Berlin, June 1934. In the early stages of the Third Reich, before the world could imagine the horrors to come, a committee of Nazi bureaucrats met to weigh the options for imposing a rigid new hierarchy, one that would isolate Jewish people from Aryans now that the Nazis had taken control. The men summoned in the late spring of 1934 were not, at that time, planning nor in a position to plan extermination. That would come years later, at a chillingly bloodless and cataclysmic meeting in Wannsee, deeper into a world war that had not yet begun. On this day, June 5, 1934, they were there to debate the legal framework for an Aryan nation, to turn ideology into law, and were now anxious to discuss the findings of their research into how other countries protected racial purity from the taint of the disfavored. They sat down for a closed-door session in the Reich capital that day and considered it serious enough to bring a stenographer to record the proceedings and produce a transcript. As they settled into their chairs to hash out what would eventually become the Nuremberg Laws, the first topic on the agenda was the United States and what they could learn from it. The man chairing the meeting, Franz Gertner, the Reich Minister of Justice, introduced a memorandum in the opening minutes, detailing the ministry's investigation into how the United States managed its marginalized groups and guarded its ruling white citizenry. The 17 legal scholars and functionaries went back and forth over American purity laws governing intermarriage and immigration. In debating how to institutionalize racism in the Third Reich, wrote the Yale legal historian James Q. Whitman, they began by asking how the Americans did it. The Nazis needed no outsiders to plant the seeds of hatred within them. But in the early years of the regime, when they still had a stake in the appearance of legitimacy and the hope of foreign investment, they were seeking legal prototypes for the caste system they were building. They were looking to move quickly with their plans for racial separation and purity, and knew that the United States was centuries ahead of them with its anti-miscegenation statutes and race-based immigration bans. For us Germans, it is especially important to know and see how one of the biggest states in the world with Nordic stock already has race legislation, which is quite comparable to that of the German Reich. The German press agency Grossdeutsche Pressedienst wrote, as the Nazis were solidifying their grip on the country. Western Europeans had long been aware of the American paradox of proclaiming liberty for all men while holding subsets of its citizenry in near total subjugation. The French writer Alexis de Tocqueville toured antebellum America in the 1830s and observed that only the surface of American society is covered with a layer of democratic paint. Germany well understood the U.S. fixation on race, purity, and eugenics, the pseudoscience of grading humans by presumed group superiority. Many leading Americans had joined the eugenics movement of the early 20th century, including the inventor Alexander Graham Bell, the auto magnate Henry Ford, and Charles W. Eliot, the president of Harvard University. During the First World War, the German Society for Racial Hygiene applauded the dedication with which Americans sponsor research in the field of racial hygiene and with which they translate theoretical knowledge into practice. The Nazis had been especially taken with the militant race theories of two widely known American eugenicists, Lothrop Stoddard and Madison Grant. Both were men of privilege, born and raised in the North and educated in the Ivy League. Both built their now discredited reputations on hate ideology that devised a crude ranking of European stock, declared Eastern and Southern Europeans inferior to Nordics, and advocated for the exclusion and elimination of races they deemed threats to Nordic racial purity, foremost among them Jews and Negroes. A racial slur that the Nazis adopted in their campaign to dehumanize Jews and other non-Aryans, the word Untermensch, meaning subhuman, came to them from the New England-born eugenicist Lothrop Stoddard. A 1922 book he wrote carried the subtitle The Menace of the Underman, which translated into Untermenschen in the German edition. The Nazis took the word as their own and would most become associated with it. They made Stoddard's book on white supremacy a standard text in the Reich's school curriculum and accorded him a private audience with the purposefully remote Adolf Hitler at the Reich Chancellery in December 1939. Well into World War II, Stoddard sat in on Nazi sterilization trials and commended the Nazis for weeding out the worst strains in the Germanic stock in a scientific and truly humanitarian way. He lamented, though, that, if anything, their judgments were almost too conservative. Madison Grant, a leading eugenicist from New York, whose social circle included Presidents Theodore Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover, converted his zeal for Aryan supremacy into helping enact a series of American immigration and marriage restrictions in the 1920s, as the Nazi Party was forming across the Atlantic. Grant went far beyond Southern segregationists in his contempt for marginalized people. He argued that inferior stocks should be sterilized and quarantined in a rigid system of elimination of those who are weak or unfit, or perhaps worthless race types. Grant published a rabid manifesto for cleansing the gene pool of undesirables. His 1916 book, The Passing of the Great Race, the German edition of which held a special place in the Führer's library. Hitler wrote Grant a personal note of gratitude and said, "The book is my Bible." Hitler had studied America from afar, both envying and admiring it, and attributed its achievements to its Aryan stock. He praised the country's near genocide of Native Americans and the exiling to reservations of those who had survived. He was pleased that the United States had shot down the millions of Redskins to a few hundred thousand. He saw the U.S. Immigration Restriction Act of 1924 as a model for his program of racial purification, historian Jonathan Spiro wrote. The Nazis were impressed by the American custom of lynching its subordinate caste of African Americans, having become aware of the ritual torture and mutilations that typically accompanied them. Hitler especially marveled at the American knack for maintaining an air of robust innocence in the wake of mass death. By the time that Hitler rose to power, the United States was not just a country with racism, Whitman, the Yale legal scholar, wrote. It was the leading racist jurisdiction, so much so that even Nazi Germany looked to America for inspiration. The Nazis recognized the parallels, even if many Americans did not. Thus, on that day in June 1934, as 17 Reich bureaucrats and legal scholars began to deliberate what would become unprecedented legislation for Germany, they were scrutinizing the United States, and they had done their homework. One of the men, Heinrich Krieger, had studied law in the American South as an exchange student at the University of Arkansas. He had written extensively about foreign race regimes, having spent 2 years in South Africa, and was at that very moment completing a book that would be titled Race Law in the United States to be published in Germany 2 years hence. The Nazi lawyers had researched U.S. jurisprudence well enough to know that from the fugitive slave cases to Plessy v. Ferguson and beyond, the American Supreme Court entertained briefs from Southern states whose arguments were indistinguishable from those of the Nazis, Whitman observed. In their search for prototypes, the Nazis had looked into white-dominated countries such as Australia and South Africa, but there were no other models for miscegenation law that the Nazis could find in the world, Whitman wrote. Their overwhelming interest was in the classic example, the United States of America. These 17 men were convening at a time of intrigue and upheaval in a country descending into dictatorship. The Nazis were in the final throes of consolidating their power after their takeover the year before. Hitler had been sworn in as Chancellor, but was not yet the Führer. That would not happen until later that summer, in August 1934, when the death of Germany's ailing president, Paul von Hindenburg, the last holdover of the Weimar regime, cleared the way for Hitler to seize total control. Hitler had made it to the chancellery in a brokered deal that conservative elites agreed to only because they were convinced they could hold him in check and make use of him for their own political aims. They underestimated his cunning and overestimated his base of support, which had been the very reason they'd felt they needed him in the first place. At the height of their power at the polls, the Nazis never pulled the majority they coveted and drew only 38% of the vote in the country's last free and fair elections at the onset of their 12-year reign. The old guard did not foresee, or chose not to see, that his actual mission was to exploit the methods of democracy to destroy democracy. By the time they recognized their fatal miscalculation, it was too late. Hitler had risen as an outside agitator, a cult figure enamored of pageantry and rallies with parades of people carrying torches that an observer said looked like rivers of fire. Hitler saw himself as the voice of the folk, of their grievances and fears, especially those in the rural districts, as a God-chosen savior running on instinct. He had never held elected office before. As soon as he was sworn in as chancellor, the Nazis unfurled their swastikas, a Sanskrit symbol linking them to their Aryan roots, and began to close in on the Jews. They stoked ancient resentments that dated back to the Middle Ages, but that rose again when the Jews were made the scapegoats for Germany's loss and humiliation at the end of World War I. Seen as dominant in banking and finance, Jews were blamed for the insufficient financial support of the war effort, although historians now widely acknowledge that Germany lost on the battlefield and not solely for lack of funds. Still, Nazi propaganda worked to turn Germans against Jewish citizens. Nazi thugs taunted and beat up Jews in the streets, and any Aryans who were found to be in relationships with them. The regime began restricting Jews from working in government or in high-status professions, like medicine or the law, fields that incited jealousy among ordinary Germans who could not afford the expensive cars and villas on the lake that many successful Jews had acquired. This was the middle of the Great Depression, and more than a third of Germans were out of work in 1933, the year the Nazis came to power. The Jews' prestige and wealth were seen as above the station of a group that Nazis decreed were beneath the Aryans. Mindful of appearances beyond their borders, for the time being at least, the Nazis wondered how the United States had managed to turn its racial hierarchy into rigid law, yet retain such a sterling reputation on the world stage. They noticed that in the United States, when it came to these racial prohibitions, public opinion accepted them as natural, wrote the historian Claudia Kunz. A young Nazi intellectual named Herbert Kier was tasked with compiling a table of U.S. race laws and was confounded by the lengths to which America went to segregate its population. He made note that, by law in most southern states, white children and colored children are sent to different schools, and that most states further demand that race be given in birth certificates, licenses, and death certificates. He discovered that many American states even go so far as to require by statute segregated facilities for coloreds and whites in waiting rooms, train cars, sleeping cars, streetcars, buses, steamboats, and even in prisons and jails. In Arkansas, he noted, the tax rolls were segregated. He later remarked that, given the fundamental proposition of the equality of everything that bears a human countenance, it is all the more astonishing how extensive race legislation is in the USA. Keir was just one of several Nazi researchers who thought American law went overboard, Whitman wrote. With the results of their research laid out before them, the men at the June meeting began debating two main pathways to their version of a caste system. First, creating a legal definition for the categories of Jews and Aryans, and second, prohibiting intermarriage between the two. Germany had looked at America's miscegenation laws decades before and tested its own intermarriage ban at the turn of the 20th century when it forbade its settlers to mix with indigenous people in its colonies in Southwest Africa. In so doing, Germany went further than most colonial powers, but it did not come close to the American model. Now Nazi extremists pushed for ways to prevent any further penetration of Jewish blood into the body of the German Volk. As the debate got underway, Krieger, the former University of Arkansas law student, reported that Americans had gone so far as to make interracial marriage a crime punishable by as much as 10 years imprisonment in many jurisdictions. He pointed out that the United States had divided its population in two with artificial line drawing between white and colored people. He and other Nazis showed a fascination with the American habit of assigning humans to categories by fractions of perceived ancestry. There is a growing tendency in judicial practice, Krieger said, to assign a person to a group of coloreds whenever there is even a trace of visible Negro physical features. The men who gathered for that meeting did not agree on how much to draw from American jurisprudence. The moderates at the table, among them the chair himself, Franz Gertner, argued for less onerous methods than the Americans were using. He suggested that education and enlightenment about the perils of race mixing might be enough to discourage Aryans from intermarrying with others. At one point, he sought to downplay the U.S. prototype because he had a hard time believing that Americans actually enforced the laws the Nazis had uncovered. Gertner simply refused to concede that the Americans actually went so far as to prosecute miscegenists, Whitman wrote. One of the hardliners at the table, the Nazi radical Roland Freisler, was impatient with the pace of the proceedings. He had joined the Nazi Party back in the 1920s and was pushing for a law to punish Jews and Aryans for racial treason if they intermarried. Time and again, he and the other extremists in the room brought the discussion back to the American statutes, explained and defended them, and tried to convince the skeptics. How have they gone about doing this? Freisler asked at one point, breaking down his research into the United States and its laws of human classification. The Americans, he explained, used a range of motley parameters to separate white people from everyone else. One state, he said, classified as non-white any and all persons from Africa, Korea, or Malaysia. In another example, he said, Nevada speaks of Ethiopians or of the black race, Malaysians, or of the brown race, Mongols, or of the yellow race. Freisler argued that the overlapping contradictions could work to their advantage. The tangle of American definitions lent a measure of latitude and a useful inconsistency to the task of human division. The Americans had come up with a definition of race apart from logic or science, an approach that Freisler called the political construction of race. What the Nazis could not understand, however, was why in America, the Jews, who are also of interest to us, are not reckoned among the coloreds, when it was so obvious to the Nazis that Jews were a separate race, and when America had already shown some aversion by imposing quotas on Jewish immigration. Aside from what to the Nazis was a single vexing omission, this jurisprudence would suit us perfectly, said Freisler, who, unbeknownst to those at the table, would one day be in a position to make heartless use of it in his career as the hanging judge of the Reich. I am of the opinion that we need to proceed with the same primitivity that is used by these American states, he said. Such a procedure would be crude, but it would suffice. The doubters continued to question the American statutes. They went back and forth on exactly how a marriage ban would work, parsed the proposed definition of Jew and Aryan, tried to make sense of the American fraction system. Moderates were disturbed by the idea that people who were half Jewish and half Aryan would be cut off from their Aryan side and deprived of caste privileges they would otherwise be accorded. Rather than defining such people as half Jewish, the skeptics wondered, would they not also be half Aryan? But one hardliner, Achim Gerke, referred back to the prototype they had been studying. He proposed a definition of 1/16th Jewish for classification of Jews, Kuntz wrote, because he did not wish to be less rigorous than the Americans. The men debated for 10 hours that day and ended without agreement. We have been talking past one another, Freisler, frustrated by the lack of progress, said toward the end. The moderates had managed, for now, to contain the radicals who had pushed for the American prototype. But 15 months later, the radicals would prevail. In September 1935, Hitler summoned the Reichstag to the annual Nazi rally in Nuremberg to announce new legislation that had been incubating since the Nazi takeover. By then, Hitler had either imprisoned or killed many of his political opponents, including the murders of 12 members of the Reichstag and of his longtime friend Ernst Röhm, the head of a Nazi paramilitary unit, the SA. All of this rendered the Reichstag a puppet arm of the government, having been intimidated into submission. At that very moment, the Nazis were building concentration camps all over the country. One was soon to open in Sachsenhausen, north of the Reich capital, and would become one of their showcases. The plan was to announce the legislation, ultimately known as the Blood Laws, on the final day of the rally. The night before, Hitler directed a small group of deputies to draft a version for him to deliver to the Reichstag to rubber stamp. The Nazi researchers had come across a provision in some of the U.S. miscegenation laws that could help them define whether a person who was half Jewish should count as a Jew or an Aryan. It turned out that Texas and North Carolina had an association clause in their marriage bans that helped those states decide if an ambiguous person was black or white, privileged or disfavored. Such a person would be counted in the disfavored group if they had been married to or had been known to associate with people in the disfavored group, thus defying caste purity. This was what Hitler announced that September and expanded in the months to come. The law for the protection of German blood and German honor defined a Jew as a person with three Jewish grandparents. It also counted as Jewish anyone descended from two Jewish grandparents who practiced Judaism or was accepted into the Jewish community or was married to a Jew, in line with the Americans Association Clause. Secondly, the law banned marriage and intercourse outside of marriage between Jews and Germans, and it forbade German women under 45 to work in a Jewish household. Thus began a campaign of ever-tightening restrictions. Jews were henceforth stripped of citizenship, prohibited from displaying the German flag, denied passports. With that announcement, Germany became a full-fledged racist regime, the historian George M. Fredrickson wrote. American laws were the main foreign precedents for such legislation. But given the Nazis' own fixation on race, the American prototype had its limits. The scholars who see parallels between the American and Nazi racial classification schemes are, to that extent, wrong, Whitman said, but only because they understate the relative severity of American law. As cataclysmic as the Nuremberg laws were, the Nazis had not gone as far with the legislation as their research into America had taken them. What did not gain traction on the day of the closed-door session or in the final version of the Nuremberg laws was one aspect of the American system. While the Nazis praised the American commitment to legislating racial purity, they could not abide the unforgiving hardness under which an American man or woman who has even a drop of Negro blood in their veins counted as blacks, Whitman wrote. The one-drop rule was too harsh for the Nazis. Chapter 9. The Evil of Silence. The ash rose from the crematorium into the air, carried by karma and breeze, and settled onto the front steps and geranium beds of the townspeople living outside the gates of death at Sachsenhausen, north of Berlin. The ash coated the swing sets and paddling pools in the backyards of the townspeople. There was no denying the slaughter and torment on the other side of the barbed wire. The fruit of evil fell upon villagers like snow dust. They were covered in evil, and some were good parents and capable spouses, and yet they did nothing to stop the evil, which had now grown too big for one person to stop, and thus no one person was complicit, and yet everyone was complicit. It had grown bigger than them because they had allowed it to grow bigger than them, and now it was raining down onto their gingerbread cottages and their lives of pristine conformity. The dissident theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer was one of the millions who suffered and perished behind the electrified walls of a Nazi concentration camp, tortured and kept in solitary confinement. Could the townspeople hear the prayers of the innocents? Silence in the face of evil is itself evil, Bonhoeffer once said of bystanders. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. The villagers were not all Nazis. In fact, many Germans were not Nazis. But they followed the Nazi leaders on the radio, waited to hear the latest from Hitler and Goebbels, the Nazis having seized the advantage of this new technology, the chance to reach Germans live and direct in their homes, anytime they chose. An intravenous drip to the mind. The people had ingested the lies of an inherent Untermenschen, that these prisoners, Jews, Sinti, homosexuals, opponents of the Reich, were not humans like themselves, and thus the townspeople swept the ash from their steps and carried on with their days. Mothers pulled their children inside when the wind kicked up, hurried them along to keep them from being covered in the ash of fellow human beings. In the middle of Main Street, in a southern American town, there stood a majestic old tree, an elm or an oak or a sycamore that had been planted before modern roads were paved. It held a sacred place in the hearts of the townspeople, though it was an altogether inconvenient location for a shade tree. It blocked traffic, coming and going, and motorists were forced to curve around it to get through town. It was the potential cause of many accidents, given that motorists could not always see past it or know for sure who had the right of way. And yet it could not be cut down. It was the local lynching tree, and it was performing its duty to perpetually and eternally remind the black townspeople of who among them had last been hanged from its limbs and who could be next. The tree was awaiting its appointed hour, and the white townspeople were willing to risk inconvenience, injury, and death, even to themselves, to keep the tree and the subordinate caste in their places. The tree bore silent witness to black citizens of their eternal lot, and in so doing, it whispered reassurances to the dominant caste of theirs. The townspeople of the East Texas village of Leesburg hammered a buggy axle into the ground to serve as a stake. Then they chained 19-year-old Wiley McNeely to it. They collected the kindling they would use for the fire at the base of his feet. Despite his protestations of innocence in connection to the white girl they said he had assaulted. 500 people gathered that fall in 1921 to see Wiley McNeely burn to death in front of them. But first, the leaders of the lynching had to settle a matter of importance. The leaders drew lots to see who would get which piece of McNeely's body after they had burned him alive, figure out the body parts which they regarded as the choicest souvenir. This they did in front of the young man facing his final seconds on this earth, there chained up and left to hear of the disposition of his fingers and ears to the men who had kidnapped him outside of the law. The leaders debated this in front of the 500 people who had come to watch him die and who were impatient for the festivities to begin. After the men had decided and after all was settled, they lit the match. The little girls appear to be in grade school, in light cotton dresses with a sailor's collar and their hair cut in precise page boys just below their ears. In the picture, the two younger girls seem to be fidgeting in shadow, close to the women in the group, who were perhaps their mothers or aunts. The girl you notice first, though, looks to be about 10 years old, positioned at the front of the group of grown-ups and children, her eyes alert and riveted. A man is at her side, crisp in his tailored white pants, white shirt, and white Panama hat, as if headed to cocktail hour at a boating party, his arms folded, face at rest, unperturbed, vaguely bored. It is July 19th, 1935. They're all standing at the base of a tree in the pine woods of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Above them hangs the limp body of Reuben Stacy, his overalls torn and bloodied, riddled with bullets, his hands cuffed in front of him, head snapped from the lynching rope, killed for frightening a white woman. The girl in the front is looking up at the dead black man with wonderment rather than horror, a smile of excitement on her face, as if show ponies had just galloped past her at the circus. The fascination on her young face, set against the gruesome nature of the gathering, was captured by a photographer and is among the most widely circulated of all lynching photographs of 20th century America. Lynchings were part carnival, part torture chamber, and attracted thousands of onlookers who collectively became accomplices to public sadism. Photographers were tipped off in advance and installed portable printing presses at the lynching sites to sell to lynchers and onlookers like photographers at a prom. They made postcards out of the gelatin prints for people to send to their loved ones. People mailed postcards of the severed, half-burned head of Will James atop a pole in Cairo, Illinois, in 1907. They sent postcards of burned torsos that looked like the petrified victims of Vesuvius. Only these horrors had come at the hands of human beings in modern times. Some people framed the lynching photographs with locks of the victim's hair under glass if they had been able to secure any. One spectator wrote on the back of his postcard from Waco, Texas in 1916, "This is the barbecue we had last night. My picture is to the left with the cross over it. Your son, Joe." This was singularly American. Even the Nazis did not stoop to selling souvenirs of Auschwitz, wrote Time magazine many years later. Lynching postcards were so common a form of communication in turn of the 20th century America that lynching scenes became a burgeoning subdepartment of the postcard industry. By 1908, the trade had grown so large and the practice of sending postcards featuring the victims of mob murderers had become so repugnant that the U.S. Postmaster General banned the cards from the mails. But the new edict did not stop Americans from sharing their lynching exploits. From then on, they merely put the postcards in an envelope. In downtown Omaha, they started a bonfire and readied it for Will Brown. The newspapers had advertised the lynching in advance, and as many as 15,000 people gathered on the courthouse square that day in September 1919. So many people that one cannot make out the faces in the human sea in a wide shot taken from above. These thousands of dots on a gelatin print, fathers, grandfathers, uncles, nephews, brothers, teenagers, were of one mind, had fused into an organism unto itself, intent on a single mission, not only to kill, but to humiliate, torture, and incinerate another human being, and together, to breathe in the smoke of burning flesh. 2 days before, a white woman and her boyfriend had said that a black man had molested her when the couple were out on the town. No one alive knows what happened for sure, and there were questions even then. Resentment had been building against the influx of black Southerners arriving north during the Great Migration, and Will Brown, a packing house worker, was the man the sheriffs arrested. There was no investigation, no due process. That day, the mob looted guns from local pawn shops and general stores and fired on the courthouse where Brown had been detained. Before they could even get to him, the mob killed two of their own, a bystander and a fellow rioter, with their ragged gunshots. They set the courthouse on fire to force the sheriff to hand Brown over to them. They cut the water hoses to keep the firefighters from putting out the blaze. And when the mayor tried to appeal to the mob, the leaders put a rope around his neck and inflicted injuries that put him in the hospital. The leaders of the mob pulled Brown from the rooftop of the courthouse, where the courthouse workers had escaped from the fire and where the prisoners had been taken. Then the people in the mob began the task for which they had gathered. First, they stripped Will Brown, and those up front fought each other to beat him. They hoisted him, half conscious, onto a lamppost outside the courthouse. Then they fired bullets into his dangling body, cheering as they fired. And it was from these gunshots that the coroner said Brown died. They burned his body in the bonfire they had made on the courthouse square. Then they tied the body to a police car and dragged the corpse through the streets of Omaha. They cut the pieces of rope they had used to hoist him, and these they sold as keepsakes for people's display cabinets and fireplace mantels. The photographers on the scene captured the lynching from different angles, and produced postcards of the men in business suits and teenagers in newsboy hats posing as if at a wedding reception, crowding into the frame above the charred torso, sparks of fire amid the ash, an image they would send to cousins and in-laws and former neighbors around the country. A 14-year-old boy was helping his father at his printing plant across the street from the courthouse in the middle of the riot. The boy's name was Henry Fonda, and he would leave Omaha when he grew up and make a name for himself as a leading man in Hollywood. That evening in 1919, against the hollers of the mob and the man hanging from a lamppost and the cinders of the bonfire, Fonda and his father locked the plant and drove home in silence. "It was the most horrendous sight I've ever seen," he would say years later when he was an old man. The decades had not swept the ash from his memory. It was perhaps no coincidence that he would appear in many movies in which he was the moral voice calling for a life to be spared. In the 1943 film, The Oxbow Incident, about vigilante violence, it is Fonda's character who warns a bloodlusting mob, "Man just naturally can't take the law into his own hands and hang people without hurting everybody in the world." Part 3. The Eight Pillars of Caste. The foundations of caste, the origins of our discontents. These are the historic origins, the pillars upholding a belief system, the piers beneath the surface of a caste hierarchy. As these tenets took root in the firmament, it did not matter so much whether the assumptions were true, as most were not. It mattered little that they were misperceptions or distortions of convenience, as long as people accepted them and gained a sense of order and means of justification for the cruelties to which they had grown accustomed, inequalities that they took to be the laws of nature. These are the pillars of caste, the ancient principles that I researched and compiled as I examined the parallels, overlap, and commonalities of three major caste hierarchies. These are the principles upon which a caste system is constructed, whether in America, India, or Nazi Germany. Beliefs that were at one time or another burrowed deep within the culture.